Does being poor cost more? How does that vary if you are also from an ethnic minority background or living in ethnic minority areas? These are some of the questions I, Ripon Ray, will ask on this month's Debt Talk podcast. To navigate yet another thought-provoking subject, this subject is poverty and ethnicity premium. I have panelists from academia, think tank, funders, and minority debt advice providers to entangle such an important issue openly in this podcast. Maria Booker, head of policy for Fair by Design, that aims to eliminate the poverty premium. Sarah Davis from Bristol University, who carried out research on poverty premium. Jerry During from Money A&E, who have been involved in minority communities and understand how being part of minority ethnic groups puts you at a significant disadvantage. And finally, Aisha Begum from Fair for All Finance, who had led some research looking at how to build inclusive access to financial services for minority ethnic communities. My panelists are also to provide Debt Talk listeners with top tips for those who are genuinely, yes, genuinely considering developing strategies to eradicate discrimination based on poverty and ethnicity. So let me start with Maria from Fair by Design. Maria, can you define what poverty premium actually means for us?
The poverty premium is the idea that the poor pay more for essential goods and services. So some examples of that could be that you pay more for your energy if you don't pay by direct debit, that you pay more for your car insurance because you can't afford to pay all in one go for the year, so you pay monthly instead. Other examples might be that many people on a low income like to budget in cash. So, depending on where you live, you might be charged a fee for withdrawing cash from a local cash machine. So, that's a poverty premium. And also, if you don't live by a large supermarket, for example, you would pay a premium if you had to shop at smaller supermarkets because they charge higher prices. Or if you could get to the large supermarket, you might not be able to pay in bulk, you might not be able to buy in bulk. So you would have to take your shopping back on the bus or you'd be walking back. So you'd pay more for that as well. So those are all poverty premiums.
I understand that Fair by Design focuses on a few targeted areas of consumer market. Which area are they, and why did you decide to focus on these areas?
So Fair by Design really came about following the publication of a really important report, which Sarah was the lead author of, and I know you're going to speak to Sarah in a minute. So the Personal Finance Research Centre at the University of Bristol, in 2016, they published a report that measured for the first time how many households were affected by the poverty premium and how much they were paying. And that report focused particularly on energy, insurance and credit as being the priority areas that we needed to address. And that's why Fair by Design has chosen to focus on those areas.
Can you tell us about some of the work you're doing at the moment to address poverty premium? And has there been any wins so far?
Yes, there has been. So on energy this year, there's been some positive developments. The main one was that in the spring budget last year, the government announced that it was going to get rid of the prepayment meter premium. So from July last year, you've no longer had to pay extra for your energy if you have a prepayment meter. And Ofgem has recently announced how it's going to make that change a permanent change, which is great news. So that's prepayment. However, if you pay when you receive your bill, so if you pay by standing order or cheque or cash, for example, when you get your bill, you still pay £106 more a year for your energy than somebody paying by direct debit. So that's still quite a big premium that we're fighting to get rid of. Ofgem have said they're looking at it, and they've said that they're minded to introduce a change that would halve that premium. So we think that's a good start, and we'll be pushing Ofgem to go ahead with that change. But ideally, we'd like them to go further. We'd like them to eliminate that premium altogether. But it's a good start. So there's some good news in energy. The not so good news on energy was that last year the government said it was going to publish a consultation on having a social tariff. So that's like a permanent discount on energy bills for people who are on low incomes. But it didn't go ahead with that consultation in the end. And that's a shame, because we know that energy prices are going to remain high for some time. They're still about 60% higher than they were prior to 2021, so before the energy crisis. So we would really like to see the government doing something permanently to support people who can't afford their energy. So we'll be continuing to campaign on that one. So just looking at insurance, there's also been some good news on insurance. So people who pay monthly for their insurance currently pay around 11% more than people who pay for the whole year in one go. So that works out to be about £122 extra per year on average. So the reason that happens is because firms treat it like a loan. They treat it as a premium finance product. And they basically charge you for having a loan out for the whole year. But the Financial Conduct Authority has said that they think that that's a bad product, a poor product, and that they've recognised that it's a poverty premium. And they've said that they want firms to look carefully at whether that fits within their obligation to offer fair value to consumers under the Consumer Duty. Just to say on credit, we are a founding partner in the No Interest Loan pilot scheme that's going on at the moment. So that's a scheme that offers small amounts of money to people who wouldn't be able to afford a commercial loan, but they don't have to pay any interest on it. And that pilot's going really well at the moment. It's due to conclude in next year in 2025. So we're hoping to see a wider rollout of that scheme in due course.
I mean, you mentioned a great deal about regulators and depending upon regulators such as Ofgem and also the Financial Conduct Authority. But in terms of the industry, what challenges do you think the industry would face to address some of these issues that we're talking about?
So I should explain that there's two parts to Fair by Design. We have a venture capital fund that invests in new businesses that are aiming to disrupt the market and to offer services that meet the needs of people on low incomes. So that's a really important part of the Fair by Design as well. And we also have the campaign team that I'm a part of. And I think it's really important to have those disruptors. You know, things can be done differently to how they've been done in the past. And it's important to have those newcomers come into the market and to show that it can be done in a different way. You do get some pushback from industry, but I think they generally want to see government and regulators setting the framework so that everybody has to compete on a level playing field. And when that happens, industry tend to follow the lead of government and regulators. And that's why we focus quite hard on making sure that market framework is right in the first place, and that firms are then incentivized to offer products that meet the needs of people on low incomes.
Normally you emphasize on people with lived experience in your work. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, we're really keen that people with lived experience of being in poverty or being on a low income are at the center of policy work and are at the center of developing new products and services. So we try and live our own values on this at Fair by Design, because we don't have an advice line or have direct contact with people on low incomes. We work very closely with an organisation called Poverty Alliance, and we've done lots of work with them. So we ran some focus groups last year on energy. We have put out a number of films that have shared the experience of people facing poverty premiums. And we've just started a new project that's going to look at bringing to life what it's like to not have access to credit. And that's going to be in a very visual way. People are going to take photos, and I'm going to put together an exhibition. It's going to be a 9-month project with Poverty Alliance, which we're looking forward to getting started on.
So let's turn to Sarah from Bristol University. Could you tell us a bit about the work that you carried out, and I know we have minority specialists who will be talking about it later anyway.
Hi, Rupen. Thanks for inviting me. The centre that I work for at Bristol, we specialise in research around household finance from a policy and practice perspective. So we're therefore interested in understanding financial behaviours as a way of helping inform policy. I think there can be a tendency in policy and regulation to produce policies that don't account for or even understand the actual behaviour, particularly for those whose lives and experiences are very different from those who make the policy. So we've conducted a lot of research around to understand behaviours of borrowing and savings, for example. And so the poverty premium really is about the other key element of household finances, which is spending. And so it was important to understand the payment needs of those on low incomes, very low incomes, and see if these needs were being served. So through talking to people with these experiences, we were able to conceptualize how and where the poverty premium arises. So that involved identifying the demand side factors. So the ways in which having constrained finances can mean avoiding direct debits, for example, some of the things that Maria was talking about, not being able to pay a large sum up front. And then how these needs are met or not met by the supply side, the markets. Do they produce products and services that meet these needs or not? And then also considering some factors that might compound the poverty premium, make it worse, such as digital exclusion or geography. Again, some of the things that Maria's talked about. So all of this helps us to understand why those in poverty pay more or why certain groups. I think it's important to justify why these premiums are disproportionately impacting those on poverty. They're not necessarily things that only people in poverty experience. For example, prior to the energy crisis, a lot of people didn't switch to the best tariff. But there are some very specific factors key to you know specific to those in poverty that can be a barrier to switching. And so that's why and how and why we end up calling something a poverty premium.
Going deeper into this subject matter and some of the research work that you and your team have conducted, what have you identified?
It's a sort of constantly changing landscape. So we've been conducting research since 2016, and with Maria, we've revisited the subject and revisited different areas. So, for example, in 2007, the Save the Children looked at the poverty premium, and at that point, pay-as-you-go mobile phones were a big part of the premium. They were far more expensive per minute or taxed than being on a contract. But by 2016 and since then, the whole nature of the mobile phone market has changed beyond recognition, really. And so pay-as-you-go now is much better value than being on a contract. So technology, the way markets change, all impact on how and why is you know what is a poverty premium? As Maria mentioned, we also look at the extra cost of buying groceries from local stores because those with limited transport options or limited mobility you know may need to call on these shops more often than those without it. And there's a very strong link between disability and poverty, for example. So it's how all these factors interact. We've with wider work that we've done, we've mapped fee charging ATMs, and they are more prevalent in areas of deprivation. So it's all those things. You know, we there are other wider discussions going on in the field. And there are a number of areas where people may in poverty may end up paying more. Travel, for example, if you have to borrow to pay for a season ticket for travel and you only have higher option, you know, higher cost credit as an option, then that's another poverty premium. So it's really just looking at what's around at the time.
Speaking of poverty premium, are things getting better or are things getting worse?
It's a bit of a mixed picture, I would say. I mean, as Maria said, there have been some wins, particularly in the energy market. The Ofgem's tariff caps, there have been a number of them over the years. They have we've charted this, the impact of these over time, and they have definitely helped people. They've reduced the poverty premium in this area, and it does demonstrate the potential for regulation to have an impact on poverty premiums. but the provision of domestic gas and energy is a fairly straightforward market. And so when you look at the more complex high-cost credit market, for example, while there have been attempts by the FCA to introduce regulation that could reduce the poverty premium, the actual result has been far more mixed. So they've introduced a cap on the total cost of credit, a cap on rent-to-own costs, but which have been successful in themselves. But as they cap one product, the market produces another. So we found that in 2020, even by 2020, there weren't payday loans. 1 month loans had disappeared, but they turned to 3 or 4 month loans where people were paying exactly the same high level of cost. And in fact, even more worrying now, we're seeing an increase in illegal lending. So you have to be very careful about how you go about introducing regulation to cap the cost of that people pay, basically.
We have identified that the introduction of artificial intelligence reinforces, I suppose, what you call ghettoization.
I think it's really important, and one of the things that's been very foremost in our research is recognizing that the poverty premium is a feature of an imperfect market, not of bad choices, and to try and demonstrate and show why people make those choices. And to do this, obviously, we've spoken to a lot of people with the lived experience of poverty and the poverty premium, and in fact doing that was really key to understanding and conceptualizing how the poverty premium came about. So we hope by putting it as a poverty premium and making it clear that it is not about bad choices, it is about choices that are made by people with constrained income, basically. We work together with Maria, with people like Toynbee Hall in London, the Poverty Alliance, Plymouth Focus Advice Centre, to make sure that we do include these voices of those who've been impacted by the poverty premium in our work. And I think as we've built on this work, we're drawing out a clearer picture of the heterogeneity of poverty and of managing on a low income. The premiums of those single mothers with young children in poverty, for example, are very different to those of older people, for example. Single mothers tend to have high cost credit usage because they need to participate in society, and to do so they have to borrow, whereas maybe working those who are on insecure work, 0 hours, they're more likely to pay on receipt of bill because they have to manage their money they have to pay their bills as and when they can. They can't afford to have a direct debit coming out. And similarly, the experiences of those from minority ethnic groups in poverty differ. And I'm Jerry and Aisha are going to talk more about that. But so I think it's recognizing that people in poverty are not one group.
But based on your analysis, though, what sort of changes do you genuinely want to see?
Well, personally, I don't think it's fair for customers of any services to be penalised for their method of payment. While it's obviously of benefit to companies to reward those who use direct debits, it's the easiest method for them. Most people who can use a direct debit will, just for the sheer ease of the method. And those who don't generally have a good reason for not doing so. I mean, I think, you know, 0 hour contracts, precarious earners, variable incomes have become so much more common, particularly in certain industries. It seems a bit ridiculous to insist that people pay by a method that was designed when most people had a fixed monthly salary. And so I think used carefully, technology such as smart meters, open banking does have the potential to support people to manage their finances in a way that works for them. But care does need to be taken, as you alluded to before, that it's used for their benefit, not for the benefit of the industry.
Now I'm going to turn to Jerry from Money A&E. Jerry, is the poverty premium something that resonates with you? And what is the ethnicity premium, and how does it vary with poverty premium that Sarah and Maria talked about?
Brilliant. Yeah, thanks for asking that, Rupon. I think so the ethnicity premium is something that we at Money A&E and another sort of debt advice and financial education sort of charity and voluntary sector organization called Rooted Finance sort of came across through basically seeing what our service users and clients were coming to us with, what were the issues that they were having. And the poverty premium is quite well known, you know, just as Maria said, it's something where poorer people are paying more for products and services than those who have sort of higher incomes. And Sarah did mention it's also about a kind of imperfect financial system. So there's kind of like a textbook definition, which is similar to the ethnicity premium. So it is about barriers within a system that means that people are in somehow paying more. If I was to give a dictionary definition of what we feel the ethnicity premium is, it's something that's a lot bigger than just sort of people's financial lives and their economic lives. It actually flows into many different areas. And I'll talk a bit later about the different areas that we see specifically. We see the ethnicity premium as a form of structural discrimination experienced by diverse ethnic communities and those from low-income groups, and it reduces opportunities and life chances. A dictionary definition should be that it's a complex set of barriers reducing economic participation, access to important goods and services, and going as far as basic human rights as well. So what I think with the ethnicity premium is that it really flows into different areas of life. It's not just our financial life. It could also be, we'll see, and also, as I mentioned, there'll be different areas like areas around sort of housing, employment, health, education, you name it. It's basically a number of different barriers that people are facing in a sort of structural system. And these barriers and challenges that they face, which essentially means, to put it simply, that they have a much poorer quality of life. They are disadvantaged in some way and they face a much poorer quality of life. They have less life chances and opportunities. So that's kind of the definition. And I think it's like I said, we've taken inspiration from the poverty premium and the barriers seen there. But it flows into so many different areas and is linked to people, particularly from diverse ethnic communities, but also from lower socioeconomic groups as well.
Are we talking about direct race discrimination or is it something else?
I think you're right. It's a mixture of both direct discrimination and indirect discrimination or structural discrimination or, you know, systemic bias. All these different names, they mean the same thing, essentially. And it means that people are more disadvantaged as a result. And we're seeing this in the work that we're doing for diverse ethnic communities. It comes up as we do our kind of monitoring, our evaluation, and we see what's happening. And it just basically means that they're facing a lot less in terms of quality of life and life chances. It's sort of that... It flows into so many different things in the sense that it's about discrimination in structures, discrimination in systems and policies and procedures, legislation and law, cultural and institutional behaviours, and how they're all designed and built and how they negatively impact on certain diverse ethnic groups and those from lower socioeconomic groups as well. So it's really about all of these different negative disadvantages which lead to a much poorer quality of life, less opportunities. But it is a mixture of direct and indirect discrimination, and it's from a variety of different aspects in life as well. It's not just economic life, not just the finance sector. It's a whole variety.
Oh, and you must have accumulated a wealth of data from those who seek advice from you. And what are your communities saying around services that they're receiving from a number of industries? And what do you take from it?
From what we've seen, so we're a kind of lived experience organization, I like to say. It's one of our values, essentially. So we were started out of the experience of myself and my co-founder Greg's own experiences of both debt, poverty, and financial exclusion and general social exclusion as well. The first area I would say is we see it quite clearly, and it's sort of evidenced in both the Fair for All finance report, but also the work that Sarah's done and Maria's spoken about in terms of the poverty premium. So in the area of the finance sector, we see lots of exclusion. And it's not just about people paying more. It's also about systems and structures that actually affect certain groups in a negative way, in an unfair way, or keep them in poverty. So that's one area, financial exclusion and poverty. Other areas include things like employment, representation within employment, within institutions as well, that are maybe delivering services, products, policies, procedures that impact these groups as well. So we see in the employment field, in the fact that there's potentially less representation sometimes of those communities within the institutions or services that are that applying the service or product that the group is impacted by. So we need more representation within those groups. That's something that we're seeing. And there's less access to really good quality jobs as well. So you've got financial exclusion and poverty. You've got this whole representation, access to good quality jobs. You've got another area, which is health, which is really around sort of well-being. We're seeing a big link in terms of negative outcomes, in terms of poor mental health and physical health. And I think lastly, a big area for us that we're seeing is housing. As I said, this with housing, we're seeing there's a lack of access to both affordable housing, long-term and good quality housing as well, leading to a kind of housing crisis as well. So these are kind of like the four areas we're seeing it in. But as I said, there'll be many other areas. There'll be areas like crime and in terms of policing, you'll see it in areas of education. It flows into so many different areas of life. But just to kind of highlight again and answer your question in terms of what we're seeing at Money Earning through our data and evaluation and collection, we also have a steering committee that help us to, the steering committee or our lived experience steering committee, so they're ex-clients or they come from the communities. They help us see what are the problems that they're facing. They tell us about our services. We also do a lot of monitoring and evaluation and research as well, both independently and internally. And all of that data is highlighting those four areas. So financial exclusion and poverty, employment in terms of representation within those organisations and access to good quality jobs, poor personal well-being linked to both mental health, poor mental health and physical health. And lastly, in the area of housing, access to both affordable but also good quality housing. And that's both in the public sector and the private sector as well. So that's the areas that we're seeing elements of the ethnicity premium coming up and create real challenges for the service users that we're trying to support in the work that we're doing in the community with a variety of different partners as well.
Are we saying all ethnics are impacted the same way? What would you say to that?
Not every sort of black man or black African man has the same experience. Not every Asian man has the same experience, depending on which country they come from, which faith group they belong to, which, small kind of subset of community group that they belong or regional group they belong to. They're all different. So we use the term diverse ethnic communities in the aim of not lumping people into one big group, because we feel that really just... It leads to ineffective policy and decision making. It leads to ineffective solutions to really tackle the problems that people face. You're looking at maybe, say, a Muslim Asian man, for example, talking about going into some of the mainstream high street banks. Some of the research that came out from the Fair for All Leveling the Playing Field report was that they're finding that a lot of the banks apply this kind of one size fits all in terms of credits and savings products. And there was a massive amount of Sharia compliant products, for example. We also, from that report, could see that a lot of sort of black people were holding less sort of security insurance products, which could help them at times of financial crisis and emergencies. we also saw that many of them who were potentially homeowners were paying a lot more or more than average, or their sort of indigenous sort of white British counterparts. They were paying more than average for their mortgage payments, and the value of their homes, especially when it was a high concentration geographically of the specific group, was lower than average in terms of the value of equity that, you know, certain houses or properties gain over periods of time. So they're very different. And I think we enter into a really big problem when we start to lump all these groups together, because a lot of these issues deserve their own specific time, their own specific solutions. We can't just create one solution and think that that's going to resolve them all. So yes, in answer to your question, no, they are very different and distinct, and it depends which area or aspect of life or which specific group we're talking about. And yes, there will be some ethnic minorities who do not face any of these problems. But what we find from statistics that we're seeing, and from various statistics of other kind of research reports that have come out, that where there is a certain ethnic group and a certain socioeconomic level, we're seeing higher instances of some of these challenges that they're having to face as a result when compared to their white British counterparts.
Do you think ethnicity is spoken more like a bit like a fashion? When you have an incident that is in public domain, such as police unlawfully searching a young girl in, let's say, in Hackney, for example, that raises an issue around injustice and fairness faced by a section of a community, and then that trickles to other communities and how minority communities are being treated by other communities as a result, and then we have more funding being spent on that community due to that incident. What would you say to that?
I think you're right. Sometimes it is a fashion. You know, we can talk about things that come up in the media. I mean, if we talk about police, you could talk about, you know, Stephen Lawrence, you could talk about Mark Duggan, you could talk about Sarah Everard. They're like three completely different issues, but they're highlighting one institution's problems that it's got in how it's behaving, how it's impacting certain groups in a negative way, and disadvantage them as a result of that. So to use that and apply that to every situation is not and never going to be the answer. Stephen Lawrence happened over 30 years ago. I remember that when I was in secondary school. That's how long ago it was. It's like over 25 to 30 years ago that happened. And we're still talking about issues with institutional racism within the police. And often putting a bit of funding aside or having a few kind of notes in the media about stuff that we're doing never really resolves the problem. I don't think that is really the best way to approach it. I mean, we're talking about sort of focus on finance. You couldn't apply, you know, the way that you would deal with, you know, issues of misogyny in the police and apply that to, you know, this situation where we're talking about, black people paying more, for example, for their mortgage, you know, and getting lesser value out of their houses. It's completely different. And what it does is it just means that the issues never really get resolved. It's often just sound bites, it's often just fashion, and sometimes money's thrown at the situation, but we're not really creating long-term solutions to the problem. And I think what's really important in order to deal with this, one thing that you can apply is a potential approach to dealing with it, which I think is really important. And it's something that we try to do at Money A&E. And what that is really trying to put lived experience at the fore. And we try to call it lived experience leadership. So what it is essentially those people that are affected by the issues you talk to them. You can't sort of research and come up with solutions in isolation. You have to talk to those who are affected by those issues, and you have to help them to explain what it is, to understand and identify it. We also believe it's really important to build the capacity of those groups so that they can be involved in helping to identify and frame the problem, but also identify and start to develop the solutions. Sorry, it helps identify the problems. They help us design and shape the solutions. And where possible, we're finding that there is massive impact in them implementing those solutions that are created. Whether it's giving advice to someone who's also been through debt, we're finding that clients tend to stick to their advice even more and find themselves getting over their debt situations quicker, or, you know, sticking with it and finding better results in terms of their well-being and impact, because they're basically getting a solution that comes from someone who's been where they are. It's almost like, you know, they see that someone who looks like them, been through the same problem, has got a better solution. And that actually translates to a wide variety of things. I'm talking about just in the advice context, but it translates to so many different areas. And we're seeing that when you get lived experience, you're able to get a much better solution design instead of solutions that are designed often in a vacuum.
And we are no doubt going to hear a bit more about leveling the playing field report, about building inclusive access for people from minority communities, from Aisha. You were also involved in that research. What do you want to see happen, knowing many reports have been written around minority question, and so we still haven't found things, but what do you want to see happen?
The first element is this idea of inclusive design. So we talked about these systems within the finance sector, which means that certain groups have been affected more. And we feel that's because in that design process, there is poor representation within those institutions of people employed across the business, having a voice in how that's designed. We also think, more importantly, that they're not hearing essentially from the community in the design. They might be hearing, but they could just taking small elements of it. And I think where you can get people employed, but you can also get consultation from those that are affected, and those who have capacity built to help, you know, design and develop services, products, policies and procedures in a better way, that really helps for much better design. So that's one of the things that's really important. And we also do some of that with our steering committee at Money A&E as well, and is some of the work that we aim to be doing as part of this collective with Fair for All Finance and Rooted Finance and a variety of other community organisations to redesign certain services. We'll first kind of research and find out what the issues are, but we're going to redesign some of those services with, you know, the kind of user voice at the heart, essentially, and hopefully being involved in the implementation as well. The other things around representation. So a lot of the institutions are part of that partnership are really, in essence, they are leaders, and that they recognize this issue that, you know, they need to have representation across their business to really be able to design products and services that meet these customers of the future, because these are customers of the future for them. And it means that their services are designed better. And obviously that means that they will do better as businesses, probably make better profits, but also be able to just have services that resonate the affected groups that we're talking about. So that representation is going to be a key thing. I think the third element is, so a number of the private sector businesses and some of the public sector will all have their own community and social resilience plans or sustainability plans, CSR, as a lot of them call it, or, you know, what they follow is something called the United Nations sustainable development goals. And one of those development goals is around poverty as well. So if we're seeing a lot of these businesses wanting to do more in this space where their sustainability plans are really linked with the community around sustainability, not only the environment, but also supporting the community and helping address issues of poverty and exclusion. We think that support and work with community and charitable organisations doing the kind of work we're all trying to do around the table here is going to be really important. But I think with a specific focus on sort of debt funding, but also on financial resilience funding and services.
Thank you, Jerry. Let me get Aisha Begum from Fair for All Finance, which has published Leveling the Playing Field report on financial services market and minority communities in particular. So Aisha, give us an overview of the report and what have you identified?
We know that people from minority ethnic backgrounds face greater exclusion in the UK, and in particular financial exclusion. And there are multiple issues that underpin that exclusion that we've heard about from the other speakers, such as education, income, socioeconomic status. But through our research, we wanted to hone in on three different areas. So we wanted to better understand how people's lived experience and their perception of mainstream financial services was. We wanted to better understand how the products and services that are currently on offer could be influencing financial exclusion. And ultimately, we wanted to understand where there are areas for improvement that financial service providers can then take action on. And the results we saw coming through from that report were stark. So people from minority ethnic groups are facing greater exclusion from the financial system right now. Some of the things that we saw were, we saw one in five people from minority ethnic backgrounds reporting they had experienced discrimination due to their race, and one in four had family or friends who had had such an experience. People told us about their experience of being treated suspiciously, getting comments that had racist undertones, or feeling looked down upon. And many of these stories of discrimination were specific to people from Black African backgrounds. We saw a real lack of trust for financial services amongst minority ethnic groups. That's based on previous experiences, the fear of discrimination, and also a lack of transparency shown by providers. We heard people saying that they would not go to their bank to get a loan because they thought that their lack of knowledge would be exploited, or that they would be provided with the wrong information. And all of this is really influencing how people then interact with their providers. So we're seeing people avoiding using the telephone or using video methods to interact with their providers. They don't go into branches. Essentially anything that might expose their ethnicity and increase that opportunity for discrimination. People, you know, use the words like it's a daunting experience for them. They spoke about avoiding going into branches as possible. But it's interesting, we didn't see that experiences of discrimination and that lack of trust, meaning that people leave their bank. It means that they essentially become disillusioned and disengage, which is problematic because it means that they are then prevented from using additional services and products that their provider might be offering. And this really, we saw this play out in how many financial products people hold. So people are from ethnic minority backgrounds hold fewer financial products that can help smooth expenses and build their long-term financial security. So things like credit cards and savings, pensions, life insurance, etc. And couple that with the fact that people from minority ethnic backgrounds are also experiencing more adverse life events or financial events. We're seeing a real disparity between need and usage. There are other many findings in the report that I'm not going to be able to do it all justice, but other things that we saw were around a one-size-fits-all approach and people feeling like their cultural and religious needs not being taken into account when designing and offering financial products and services. There was a real need for more culturally appropriate advice and clearer communication. And that's in things like financial language, but also supporting those with English as a second language. Other things we looked at in the report were around what are the alternatives people are turning to if their mainstream providers are not meeting their needs. We saw people turning to their community, so through informal community-based schemes because of trust and those being rooted in community. And also there was a real pull factor towards fintech organization. They were viewed more favorably because of a perceived sense of an easy sign-up process, people feeling like they can manage their money better, feeling more in control, and also remote sign-up with fintech organization. So overall, what we were seeing is people from minority ethnic backgrounds are facing multiple barriers to accessing mainstream finance. And we need to delve into each of those issues one by one to better understand where improvements can be made.
Jerry summarized, not all ethnic groups are the same, but from your report, could you break it down for us?
Yeah, absolutely. And I completely agree with Jerry in saying different ethnicities, it can't be homogenized into one big group. And we disaggregated our data and findings where possible and where appropriate. One of the things that we saw was actually many of our findings were seen across all ethnic groups. But some of the key differences that we saw, which I just mentioned, was around the levels of discrimination people were facing. So it was one in five across all minority ethnic groups, but it was one in three when looking at people from Black African backgrounds. Other things we saw was around the desire to see more tailored products and services based on cultural or religious needs. And this was particularly higher for those from Asian Pakistani or Asian Bangladeshi groups. And these groups in particular were also more likely to look favorably upon fintech organizations and use them as their main account compared to a traditional high street bank. We also saw things around where people go for information. So popular sources of information such as moneysavingexpert.com are not cutting through with people from minority ethnic backgrounds, and especially those from Black African backgrounds. And then more sort of holistically, we saw there are differences across ethnic groups when it comes to generational differences of areas such as credit, savings and debt, and also attitudes towards how generational wealth is built and carried through generations. And this will be influenced by people's cultural needs and preferences, and also people's experiences that they will have heard from their parents and grandparents when they moved to the UK.
What implementation do you want to see from stakeholders based on the outcome of the report?
I really wanted to use this research to affect meaningful change. We already know financial institutions are doing lots in this area, and there's lots of good practice. And some of this is highlighted in the report. But we know that there's more that can be done. And we developed seven calls to actions for financial service providers to take forward. And these are applicable to many sectors beyond financial service institutions as well. But in summary, they center around how can institutions use inclusive design to really bring people's experiences and voices into not only shaping product development, but also how those are tested and distributed, how bias can be removed in decision making and improve the products and services that are being offered. How can institutions improve the transparency and remove barriers to access? So that's things around language, and not only financial language, but also language for those with English as a second language. And so looking at translations, looking at the documentation required to access different products and services. How can financial institutions be working with the wider community? And that will serve many purposes. That will help people understand the needs of different ethnic groups better. And that will then shape that inclusive design element. It will help build trust. As we know, trust is low across financial institutions, and also help utilize the voice of trusted figures already within those communities to amplify information. And that can more holistically help improve access and trust. Jerry spoke about it already, but how can cultural representation be improved? And that goes across all parts of the business, not just at board or leadership level, but how can that be brought into design teams, customer service teams, etc. And then we also had a call on regulation as well. So we had the Consumer Duty regulation come into play last year. How can we apply an ethnicity lens to that when we're looking at customer harms and customer protection? And can regulation support the sector to improve their products and services to improve outcomes when looking at people from ethnic minority backgrounds? We have set up a group on the back of this research. And so we've been delighted at the response that we've had from mainstream banks, building societies and challenger banks so far. It's a group that have come together to work collaboratively to take these calls to actions and think about what solutions can we build and deliver on the back of it. And we are really encouraging others to join that and work with us. So really looking forward to people getting in touch to get involved in that space.
Thank you for sharing your insights, Aisha. I'm sure we shall hear more of this issue in years to come. For those who are listening to Get Talk and want to share your experience or are interested in hearing a topic of your choice, get in touch formally on Twitter at yourdoctordet or email me ripon.ray@yourdoctordet.com. Let me get back to my panel members to provide listeners with top tips for those who are genuinely considering developing strategies to eradicate either direct or indirect discrimination based on poverty and ethnicity. So let me start with Maria from Fair by Design first.
If you're a consumer, it's worth considering shopping around. You shouldn't have to do that, but it can be a way of getting a better deal on big ticket items like energy and insurance. Say if you are a policymaker, if you work in central government or local government or in a regulator, then try and really think about the impact of your policies on people on low incomes. Explicitly think about that. It's very easy to say that's just the way the market works, we can't do anything about it, but it doesn't have to be like that. The market should really serve our values as a society. And finally, before you get lots of other good top tips, I'm sure, I'd just say the best way of understanding the impact of policies or products and services on people is to actively ask them. So as you've heard from all of the speakers, it's really good to involve people with lived experience in your work. And Fair by Design and the Money Advice Trust have published some guides to inclusive design for regulators and for firms. They're available on our website. You can download them free of charge. I'd really encourage people to look at those.
And now to Sarah from University of Bristol.
I don't have much more to add than what Maria said. Obviously, we work very closely together. I think both Aisha and Maria have mentioned inclusive design, and I think for businesses, it's really important for them to understand the needs of people who are excluded through their income, through their ethnicity. But I think in a wider picture, really, we need to consider whether markets are the best way of serving, delivering essential services to people. You know, once you bring in the idea of which customers deserve better, which customers don't, being the best customer, I think you're already going to disadvantage people who are generally marginalized. So I think for essential services, maybe we ought to consider less of a market.
Thank you, Sarah. Now let me move on to Jerry.
Institutions who've heard this and want to kind of get involved from public, private and voluntary sector, we will be doing some work called sort of racial justice in finance, equity work, and we are recruiting to a racial justice in finance network. And I would say that they should get in touch with us at Money A&E, but also Fair for All Finance as well, and Aisha, and we can obviously kind of talk to them a bit more about some of the work that we're going to be doing there to kind of combat some of those challenges that we spoke about in terms of the ethnicity premium. So that's for public, private and voluntary sector organisations. And for individuals who've been affected by certain issues within the banking sector and they want to kind of get involved, they want their voice to be heard to explain the issues that they're facing, I would say to get involved, we get to contact us at Money A&E and Rooted Finance. You can find us on Google. And our co-creation team will get in touch, and people can potentially either be involved in some of the research that we'll be doing to highlight more of these issues and find some of those solutions. And they may also be able to join a practitioner panel of lived experience experts that we are also trying to build.
Finally, Aisha from Fair for All Finance.
So we've heard it from everyone, really, the importance of bringing people's lived experience into developing strategies and all the way through that process is really, really key. The other things I'll add are around how do we use that for inclusive design? How do we measure and report throughout these changes to make sure meaningful change is happening? And I think I'll leave it with being able to create improvements for the most disadvantaged in our society will benefit everyone. Everyone will see the benefits of inclusive design and bringing about improvements.
I would like to thank my panel members for giving their precious time out of their busy lives and no doubt busy schedule on a pressing subject: poverty and ethnicity premium. My next podcast is on UK waters and our bills. As you can imagine, your bills have gone up while the quality of our waters in the UK and sea are going down. You'll find more about it at next month's podcast. Thank you for listening to the Debt Talk podcast with me as your host, Ripon Ray.